morning.
Morning.
My name is Gary Cornwell. I'm here representing the interest of Dr. James Grubbs and the United States of America in this case. We asked for oral argument. I think we're the only party that did. So, number one, thank you for granting it. What I put in my little statement in my brief that I wanted to discuss with you was what you might do to provide guidance to lawyers like me and district courts in resolving motions under Rules 9 and 12 when the issue is the federal the False Claims Act in a QUITAM context. The court has, and that's what I'd really like to talk about today, which is a little different than whether or not we're going to win this case. I think we should win this case. I think we should win it on two grounds. Number one, I think that our Second Amendment complaint was sufficiently particular under the historic rules that the Fifth Circuit has announced, the who, what, when, where of the matter. And you have always said that it is fact-specific. How particular a complaint must be is fact-specific. I agree with that. I think our Second Amendment complaint was adequate under those standards. I've been drafting these things for off and on for 38 years. I draft in the way I always have. I practiced most of my career in the federal courts. I did what I think the Fifth Circuit requires. On the other hand, if you disagree with me, if you think the district court was right, we immediately provided almost all of the information the district court said we were missing from our complaint, which I think went way too far for a lot of reasons. But we provided that immediately, even before the district court had passed on the magistrate's recommendation. So I think we should win.
Why didn't you provide that to start with?
Because
that's the only part, I mean, I have to say that's the one part, the most salient feature of this case, is that you apparently had the information to begin with.
Absolutely.
And you didn't provide it. What
right.
kind of a game is that? Why do we have to put up with that?
It's not a game. And
well, we wouldn't even be here if you'd done it right the first time.
That's true. But we read the law. We believe the defendants were wrong. We believe what they were asking for and attempting to do was to use a Rule 12 and Rule 9 motion to get discovery. And there are a lot of differences between discovery and pleading a case. So we felt that we didn't need and shouldn't have to do it, and that would be stuff that we provided pursuant to discovery. As an example, I mean, there's lots of examples of this. They wanted us to attach the actual claims filed with the government. We had those, but it's illegal. We couldn't do it because we needed a discovery order, which we asked for and didn't get because all discovery was postponed. And it would be illegal under HIPAA for us to have done that without a court protective order. So that's the reason we didn't do it. And I think that the whole issue here is what that balance is between pleading and evidence and proof and evidentiary detail that is appropriate for, number one, discovery, and number two, for motion for summary judgment and trial. In fact, this court has said in the past, plaintiffs are entitled to discovery before being required to list every false claim, its dates, the individuals responsible, and why each patient was not eligible for Medicare. Well, that's the kind of detail that this court required. So I read your cases, and I decided they were wrong. I still think they were wrong. Obviously, if the district court, however, I will tell you this, I will admit this readily, had the district court ever said to me, I think Clawson out of the 11th Circuit provides a good standard, and I want you to put this stuff in your complaint if you can do it, I would then have known the risk I was taking by not doing it, and obviously my own conduct in this case indicates I would have done it. I wouldn't have agreed with the district court, but I would have put that in up front. Now, that would have taken, I mean, and again, this is something I wanted to address in terms of what I'd like to see come out of your opinion if you would consider doing this. District judges, in this case the magistrate, spent a lot of time reading all of our motions. He then made up his mind what he wanted to do. He reached an opinion. He then took a lot of time writing it. Instead of doing that, if he'd had a hearing and just said to me, you know, I think Clawson's right. I think these defendants are right. Put this in your complaint if you can. I would have done it. I would have disagreed with him. I would have disagreed with him for a lot of reasons. I would have also disagreed with him because of the fact that I think Clawson is a bad decision. It is an impractical decision. If you decide that that's the way you want these kind of pleadings to be done, well, lawyers like me will know it, and we'll do it that way next time. But I didn't believe it was proper. And, you know, one of the reasons you mentioned in the last arguments here, practicalities. One of the practicalities is, in other words, you have always, this court has always made it very clear that it is particularized to the case. The amount of particularity depends on the case. Meaning, like in this case, we had a conspiratorial conversation. In most QUETAM cases, you don't get that. The defendants explained they were all in it to defraud the government under Medicaid. We don't have that in most cases. So part of what is needed is the facts of the, I mean, part of what is needed in terms of particularity depends on the facts of the case. Perhaps more importantly, what is needed in terms of particularity as a practical matter must depend upon where the QUETAM plaintiff was situated in the scheme. And it depends on the way the organization works. It depends on how it's structured and where he fits. Is he an accountant? Did he help prepare the actual documents that were submitted to the government? Was he a doctor's assistant and got this from conversations? On and on and on. So the amount of particularity that a plaintiff can provide must also depend upon the case. The real bottom line test is, do you satisfy the basic requirements of Rule 9, which are very legitimate and I have no quarrel with, which is being sure up front that the QUETAM plaintiff isn't just making this stuff up. He has a good solid basis for bringing the complaint. The defendants have the ability to respond by filing an answer. All the things the courts say about Rule 9, there's nothing wrong with those at all. But what goes into the complaint has to depend on the circumstances. So, with that in mind, what I would like to do is talk about what I'd like to see in the opinion. And I think, you know, I think we should win under one of two grounds. But it makes a big difference on which ground we win, to me, and I think it should make a big difference to the court. If you were to reverse this, which I think you have every right to do, on the basis that my Second Amendment complaint had enough particularity in it, you send a certain message. If you reverse this on the grounds that my Third Amendment complaint should have allowed me to file it, which has all this particularity, which I think is really evidentiary and goes way beyond what this court has ever said before, you send a totally different message. So what I would like to talk to you about for a minute is what I think you should put in your opinion. And furthermore, it doesn't depend on whether I win or not. You could deny me the relief I want, which obviously I hope you don't. But even if you do that, what I'm getting to say I think is important because it will tell lawyers like me and judges what they can do better in the future. And there is, and I'm saying this, I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I like your rule about particularity, but the reason it's good and right is it focuses on circumstances, facts. Okay? And what you said is, we can't give you all that much guidance. You said this in your opinions. We can't give you very much guidance because every case is different. What I'm going to suggest to you has nothing to do with the cases. I'd like to see the following things in this opinion, whether I win or lose, or whatever ground I win or lose on, because they're matters of law. We spent hundreds of hours writing motions and responses. We've read hundreds of QUETAM cases. And there is all kind of language in all those cases, district courts, circuit courts, all over the board, which doesn't readily answer these questions. So the defendants would raise one of these points, and I'd have to go spend a lot of time trying to find an answer to it somewhere. Well, False Claim Act cases are common. Medicare, Medicaid is the biggest fraud, government fraud in the country. More cases involve that than probably anything else. This would be of great help if you could do this. And it's a matter of law. It's not fact dependent. So here's my list, if I could just go through it real quickly with you. First, it is not necessary to put in a complaint the complete who, what, when, and how. You've required the who, what, when, and why. Now, the magistrate said put the complete who, what, when, and how in there. And what he meant by that was not the complete list. He meant the complete details of everything in the list, and you know that by reading his order. He didn't want to know just merely who. He wanted to know who all. He wanted to know not only what defendant, but what assistant he used to file the thing, and on and on and on. Those are evidentiary details. I don't think that that is appropriate under the law. It is not what Rule 9 requires. And in fact, to illustrate this, there was a case, not one of yours, but we had to look elsewhere for these answers, where the court said, look, we don't want a novel. We want the first paragraph of a newspaper article. That is the basic description of who, what, when, and where. It is not the evidentiary detail that comes out in depositions, goes into summary judgments, and is presented at trial. The next thing, it is not necessary as a matter of law to put in a qui tam complaint the amount of any particular claim, or the amount of the loss, or, as it was phrased in some of the cases, what that person obtained thereby. That is important for other kinds of cases, such as security law cases. But in this case, the defendants picked up the security cases, and so did the district court, the magistrate below, and said, okay, you've got to put that in here. That's important in securities cases because you have to show that there was approximate cause injury from the conduct. You don't have to show that in a federal False Claims Act case. Loss is not an element. And incidentally, we pleaded three things. Sections 3729A, 1, 2, and 3. One is false claims, 2 is producing false documents, and 3 is conspiracy. You don't have to plead that for any of those. Now, one of your cases suggests that answer, Peterson, your case in 1975, it's in our briefs. The magistrate cited Clausen and concluded that that False Claims Act involves damages to the public fisc. It doesn't. It involves the potential of damages to the public fisc. And in fact, the case that Clausen cited that the magistrate relied on did not say that at all, did not say that you have to prove damage. Well, if you don't have to prove damage, then you don't need the amount of the claim in there.
Are you familiar with, or did you maybe even cite to us, the district court case out of the District of Columbia, X-Rel Pogue versus
yes.
Diabetes?
Yes, sir.
All right. And Chief Judge Lambert there
criticized Clausen.
Well, but what he said was, I think, precisely what you're saying, that he sees Clausen as seeking proof rather than particularity.
Right.
At odds with notice pleading. Of course, notice pleading is long gone. But.
Right. And on this point, there's another case, Goudar. It's a recent opinion by Judge Lake. It's 512 Fed Sup 920. He goes through the law, including the Supreme Court law, making it very clear that the False Claim Act cases, the False Claims Act does not require proof of damage or loss on part of the government. The next item, number three. These cases under the False Claims Act do not require precise dates that any claim was filed, even for a Section 1 case, which is the filing of claims. It only requires that a claim be filed. You said, tell us how or when. We did that. But there's a difference. I happen to know, and we put it in our third complaint, exactly when. I didn't put it in the beginning just because I would read your cases, and I said, okay, we told you what the claim was. We told you, in the complaint, we said, okay, here's the nature of the claim. Here's the reason it's false. Here's the date of the care that was supposedly rendered. And, you know, obviously the claim was filed right after that. On top of that, these guys know when the claim was filed, so they can file a responsive pleading. It's their records. If we tell you the date of the care and what the claim exactly was, they can figure out. Well, okay, so we had it. We put it in when the court finally said, put it in. But a lot of qui tam plaintiffs won't have that information, even if they stood by and watched it, even if they filled it out. They can be fired, and then they can go away, and then, you know, in fact, firings oftentimes are instant. They walk in and say, pack your stuff and get out. This guy might have even been the guy filing the claims, and he sat there for months watching false claims be filed by himself because he was told to do it. Now he's a qui tam plaintiff. He can't tell you the exact date. He can tell you, well, I saw him filed in October, November, December, January. But in other words, You shouldn't be requiring things that, as a practical matter, might not be available if the complaint still satisfies the legitimate objectives of Rule 9. Next, the precise...
Your light is on. Do you want to use some of your rebuttal time?
I don't mind. I'd like to, if you don't mind.
It's all right with me.
I'd like to tell you what I'd like to see in the opinion, if you don't mind.
But you've only got five more.
I understand. I'll go quickly.
All right.
Quitam complaints under the False Claims Act should not require the names of everyone who had a part in the filing. The regs make very clear, we cite this in our brief, the Medicaid regs, the doctor is responsible. If he puts a low-level employee and bookkeeper there and says, you know, lets him file false claims, we don't have to give you the name of the bookkeeper. The regs say very plainly, the doctor's responsible. We gave you the doctor's name. The court below wanted the name of who actually prepared the file and filed the false claim. It's not required under the Act. The invoice number of the false claim should not be required in these cases. Copies of the actual false claims should not have to be attached to complaints. In this case, it would have been illegal for us to do it because it would have revealed confidential patient information, even if we tried to redact it by taking the patient's name out. There's a lot of cases on that, big fight over what you have to do not to violate HIPAA. Attaching stuff would have been illegal. Next, it is not required in these cases that each defendant file a false claim. The magistrate reports seem to hold this. But, in fact, another phrasing of this is, in Section 3 conspiracy cases, a quitam plaintiff must plead that a violation of 3729A, the false filing statute, occurred as a predicate for a conspiracy. That just is not the law. This is not a necessary predicate to conspiracy. There must be an overt act, but not a false filing to satisfy the third section. The magistrate below, when he got to that, just kind of brushed over conspiracy, said, well, I find your specification on the overt acts, the false claims, isn't detailed enough, so I'm going to throw the conspiracy out. You don't even have to file a false claim under the conspiracy section. This is an old principle. It goes back to Cates, which is a Pennsylvania case in 1976. If you cite check Cates, you'll see all kinds of other cases that follow the same principle. Hill, Union City, Mayfair Construction, Bluesel, BLUSAL meets. And, of course, the magistrate reached this conclusion erroneously by citing the cases that don't really hold that. And then, of course, this court, incidentally, to the best of my knowledge, has never decided that issue. I'm pretty sure I'm right after reading all these cases. I'd like to see in your opinion, am I right or wrong? I don't think you have to file a claim in order to satisfy Section 3, conspiracy under the False Claims Act, 3729A3. I don't think you have to. The Allison case by the Supreme Court, which I sent you all in a letter day before yesterday, I think also makes this clear. Under Section 2 and Section 3, there is no requirement that the defendant file any false claim. You either create a document, like some of the defendants did, Bagri in this case, with the idea of it facilitating a false claim, or you engage in conspiratory, you agree with people, and then you do an overt act. The overt act does not have to be the filing of a false claim.
Is he out of his 5 minutes, too? You got a minute left.
I'll go ahead and finish.
All right.
As they always say, I trust you to respond to whatever the defendants say. And under the law, in a false claim case, you should not have to, every allegation in the complaint does not have to be with particularity. We spent tons of hours arguing over this. Another example of this is, you don't have to plead with particularity that you are the independent source of the information. You don't have to plead that this is not based on public disclosure with particularity. The reason is, Rule 9 requires only that the circumstances constituting fraud be pled with particularity. We spent untold hours arguing over whether they claimed it, and I had to refute it, that every allegation in our complaint has to be pled with particularity. And finally, you don't have to put in these cases that every defendant participated equally in all parts of the conspiracy or even was aware of the full scope of the conspiracy or was aware of all actions taken by all other conspirators, because that's not part of conspiracy law. If you and I agree to rob a bank, and in the process you decide that, well, your strategy is to go in and kill everybody so there's no witnesses, I'm responsible. I didn't have to know that that was part of your plan. So if they were in it to defraud Medicare, which the evidence in this case reflects on the face of the complaint, they didn't have to all do the same kinds of things or know the full scope of it. And finally, of course, on the issue that you raised, I would like to see in your opinion the fact that if that the district court, it would be an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny a motion to amend a petition without letting the plaintiff know that the court believes there are certain deficiencies. The court never let me know that in this case. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Old.
Yes, Your Honor, my name is Jay Old, and I represent Dr. Groves, but because there's a lot of us, and a lot of defendants, appellees, I'm going to try to take some time today to talk on some global issues. And the global issues I was prepared to talk on, although I'll talk about anything the court desires, really firstly deal with the decision to deny the leave on the third amended complaint, as well as the ambit, if you will, of 9B and 12B6 leading into the conspiracy aspects of the case. I'd like to correct a few quick things if I could. To say that this court has never decided whether or not you had to have submitted a false claim is just wrong. The Russell case says that's the central issue, is whether or not a false claim was submitted.
What do you do with Allison?
Allison, I think, actually even goes better for this court in controverting what Mr. Cornwell says, because the Allison, he just told the court you don't have to have intent. He said you don't even have to plead that someone was aware they were part of a conspiracy.
Yeah, the difficulty I have with this is the effort to achieve substantive goals by playing with the pleading rules. It turns the world upside down. You spend untold hours quibbling over words. No one knows the truth. And the truth of the matter is Congress has not, unlike the securities field, they've not come in and told the courts that the quitam actions are to be discouraged for abuse and you will use the pleading devices to do it. And I'm going to tell you from the jump start, you're going to have a hard time persuading me that we should be tightening the rules of pleading on this side of it further than they already are by transporting congressional expressions in the securities markets area. Because that's the only source of authority for doing that. Yeah. And the gloss that's being put on these things by magistrate judges who are doing it because district judges don't get to it, it simply won't cut it. Now, that said, this is a different case. I just want you to understand.
Right.
I have a view about this, and it's considered view, and it's based on the case law. It's not based on, and it's based on the basic authority of court. I don't understand why you go plead one time, plead two times, you're out of here. We're not going to let you. You tighten the pleading rules, and then you ignore the leave shall be freely granted standpoint. It has become a gotcha game, and that's not the way to defend cases.
Your Honor, let me respond to your first comment, and then I'll get to the second. The first one, Judge Higginbotham, we're not here asking to extend the rules or to tighten the rules. We think the Russell case clearly addresses the pleadings rules that you need in order to affirm the district court's decision on the second amended complaint. The Clausen case follows Russell. It merely says when analyzing Russell, these are certain facts that the courts may look to determine what the indicia of reliability is in the complaint.
If you file a complaint for civil fraud, do you say that these are the pleading standards that would apply under 9B?
9B is the rule that's been on the books forever. I mean, they knew, Judge. What he said is he knew exactly what his pleading requirements was, but he held it back because he didn't want to give the defendants the information he didn't want to give them.
Well, 9B is not a new rule. It is.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right. But 9B was part of a package that was in place for many years, and suddenly what we find is that 9B is being read with the particularity requirement is being read with far more exactitude and demands than has been before. And now my question to you is, where does that come from? And it comes from, I read it, it's come because people get the message over here in the securities area that this is what they're going to do. And if they're not doing that, I don't know why they cite securities cases.
Well, again, Clausen cites you, Judge Higginbotham. It picks Russell for that. And there are other cases that are securities cases that are certainly leaking into this analysis that talk about what type of particularity then may be required. But here, that's just simply not what we had here. We had what you had, and if we look at the docket sheet and we see what Judge Crone had first, then Judge Giblin, who was a former prosecutor, and then Judge Crone had, okay? First of all, you had a case that was presented to the U.S. attorney. It was presented in toto, according to the pleadings before the court, according to this record. The U.S. attorney declined to hear the case, to take the case, as is their right. Then we go before, it's unsealed. We respond with motions to dismiss the original complaint. We then have a first amended complaint that he wants to file. We had in the interval a hearing. It was a session with Judge Crone where we were brought in, as she does in all her cases, as you encourage, to have the party sit down and explain the case with the court. And we spent a couple hours down there doing that with her. Then we talked about the issues, the evidence, concerns about HIPAA. We talked about all of those things. Discovery issues. Mr. Cornwell wanted discovery right away. We wanted to know what the suit was about. She then grants, with I think there were five motions to dismiss pending, she grants leave to have a new amended complaint filed, at which time she admonished the defendants, don't file frivolous motions to dismiss. If he gets it right, then let's leave it alone. That's the order he now says, which he never brought before the court, somehow misled him. But that's before the first amended complaint was filed. He filed the first amended complaint. 10 pleadings were filed by the defendants saying that pleading is insufficient. The case moves then from Judge Crone to Judge Giblin. It's fully briefed. He elects, Dr. Grubbs' counsel elects to file the second amended complaint, only adding the John Doe defendants. There wasn't a hearing at which someone said, that's all you need. There's no order in the record. There's nothing in the record that supports that suggestion. He elected, with 10 pleadings from us saying you need more, to file simply a change of names on defendants. Now, we now know all along that he had a whole lot more information than that he chose to hold back, and that's a strategic gamble he took. But it's not an extension of the pleadings requirements. He had 3 bites before he filed the motion for leave after Judge Giblin suggested the case be dismissed. He had 3 bites. I'm not aware of a single case out of this circuit that says you get 4 bites. But more importantly, we need to look at what then Judge Crone had when she was looking at his motion for leave to file the third amended complaint. All that motion says is, I don't think the defendants are correct, but I'm going to give you something anyway because I've known it all along. He didn't explain at all the delay. He didn't explain anything at all about whether this was prejudicial to the defendants who've been waiting and asking for this, who've been in front of her asking for it for almost over a year at that point. And so instead, he simply laid behind the law. Now, what does she have the opportunity to look at? According to Foman versus Davis and other courts, cases, including cases out of this court, where she's then looking at, did he have multiple opportunities to correct this? He did. But did he? He did not. She's looking at, what are the reasons for that? What are the prejudices to the parties for that? And finally, she has a chance to look at, is it futile? Something you said a minute ago, Judge King, tipped me off on this. You suggested that we wouldn't be here today if he had just done what he did in the third amendment complaint. But the problem is, what he did then was plead right into the Reagan case, and he established he doesn't have direct and independent knowledge. He got all this information from a public source, which this court in the Freed case, we supplied you all that with a letter the other day, or Fried, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, he got all this information from an Open Records Act request or from patients, not his direct information. He tries to cobble it all together using all this public information that was available to the federal government through the Medicare, Medicaid submissions
whose
process.
Whose time are you using now?
Oh, have I left?
Which
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't. I'm standing.
Which of your colleagues are you throwing over the side?
They may give me a minute, but I'm almost done. But you give me.
You and your colleagues are almost done.
They'll yield. Thank you. I think I'm covering it. But Your Honor, the whole point being, when we talk about, you mentioned earlier, I thought you were maybe talking about Judge Schell earlier in the first argument. I couldn't tell which judge you were talking about, but you said this trial judge is a very good judge and a good person. Well, Judge Crone and Judge Giblin are not only very good judges and good persons, but they're very learned, especially Judge Crone, who I had the pleasure of working with before she went on the bench. She's one of the brightest people I know. She had worked with the parties. She knew what this record was. She had seen all these motions. She'd admonished us not to waste anyone's time. And then she decided, based upon what was in front of her, that this was either futile or that it was dilatory and unsupported by anything that Mr. Cornwell or Dr. Grubbs had given her to explain why they had waited. The very first question you asked. She didn't abuse discretion.
Okay,
she did exactly what.
Well, don't read too much into the first question I ask. Okay?
Sorry. Well, but I think then we get to the purposes of Rule 9B, and Mr. Cornwell suggested to the court a little while ago something completely contrary to those purposes. As the court says in the Wilkins case, Judge Rosenthal reminded us, and it's been followed by a lot of other courts, including this one, in various contexts. Rule 9B is there to cut off the discovery engine before it gets started, to first find out whether or not there's sufficient information to put the defendants on notice. And if you look at the first complaints, the first three complaints here, there's no information for the defendants. And if you look at all four of them for Dr. Groves, my client, and Dr. Cantagotti, who were simply at a dinner conversation, there's still no information as to them. And so then you look at, we're going to protect from frivolous lawsuits. We're going to protect the local people who were subjected to this litigation. We can talk about a system gone awry, rife with fraud, doctors are horrible, hospitals are horrible. Wait a minute. These are local psychiatrists in the only psychiatric hospital in Southeast Texas. They're before the courts all the time. This judge knows these doctors. It's appropriate for the community standard from the trial judge on the ground looking at the facts to say, I'm going to protect these physicians or any other objects of a False Claims Act case until there's sufficient proof to show it warrants it, because their reputations, the community's reliance and trust in the healthcare system here is important. But then there's another point.
Now, you're using all of your colleagues' time.
I'm almost there. One last point, and you said it, Judge Higginbotham.
It's up to
and
them.
Russell. Can I have one more minute? In the Russell case, when you said, we're not going to let this QTAM plaintiff relate or file one more petition or complaint, you said, look, the government has to have a chance to look at the evidence and make its decisions, too. And they're purchasing information that's otherwise not available. And for all these reasons, the court was right. The 9B protection is there and it's valid. And it needs to be supported. It doesn't need to be abused by engrafting the fraud, securities fraud, and other law into it where it's not necessary. But where practical, as Dr. Grubbs' lawyer suggested, it is important to have guidance on what you should be looking for to meet these hurdles.
Well, I'm glad to hear that Judge Crone, just the district court here, actually sat down with the lawyers. One of my concerns has been the paper shuffling that goes on. We see so much of, and you don't see judges unless it's a magistrate judge, and it's all done on the papers.
No, she meets with us on every single case, and we meet at length.
I confess, and it's my experience that the judge ought to sit down get their hands on the files and talk to the lawyer.
And she also admonishes us, as you saw in this order, which is docket entry 59, where she says, don't waste my time with motions that don't belong in front of me. And we get that in every case, too, on the defense side. Thank you.
How much time is left? 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
You're it?
I guess I'm it.
For 5 minutes.
Mitchell Toots, Your Honor. So I represent Dr. Baggery. However, I'm speaking on behalf of Dr. Kulkarni and Dr. De Silva and Canagotti. There are two physicians that are currently pro se in the case. The first thing, I agree with Mr. Old, the defendant's position is not that we need to change the rules and that we need to go to some ridiculous standard in pleading. Most of my work is similar to what Mr. Cornwell does. I have to plead these QI-TAM cases all the time. I certainly don't want to have to prove my case within the pleadings. But this is different. In his brief, in his reply brief on page 19, and this is Mr. Cornwell talking about the third amended complaint that he asked the court to allow him to file. He says that in the other physician's brief, which is our brief, footnote 2, they assert that the plaintiff's proposed third amended complaint did not contain any allegations of false claims submitted by defendants Groves, Kulkarni, or Baggery. And then he goes on to say that statement is true. Even in the third amended complaint, Mr. Cornwell admits that he has not even an allegation that these three physicians filed a false claim. We're not talking about did something false and then sent it into the government and got paid.
Well, do they have to in a conspiracy?
Well, they have to in a conspiracy, at least that there was a conspiracy to commit a false claim.
Well, I mean, the completing the thought of what you just read is they didn't personally file false claims, but it doesn't mean that, at least from an allegation standpoint, they weren't all tied up together.
Correct. Now, that's what he says. He goes on to say, well, this is irrelevant because I've filed a conspiracy claim. However, when you look at the pleadings on conspiracy, the conspiracy or the conversation in which he formulates the conspiracy is at a seafood restaurant with only two of the seven physicians. There are no allegations whatsoever that any of these other physicians ever said they were part of that conspiracy or part of an agreement to do anything.
You know, in any other case but this QI-TAM under Rule 9, this argument would be coming on a JMOL appeal.
Right.
And I cannot get past what Judge Higginbotham would say. You shouldn't have to try your case before you know you're even there.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. But when you look at, going back to Russell, what Russell says is you've got to have direct knowledge. You have to have independent knowledge. When you look at these pleadings and what happened here, this relator does not have knowledge. If he had knowledge, why didn't he say it in his pleadings? With Dr. Baggery, he says, the only thing he says about Dr. Baggery is he filed false progress reports. Why? Were they the wrong date? Was it the wrong patient? Was there a misspelling in the word? There's no allegation that he intentionally put false things in a medical record because then it was going to be billed and then maybe he might be getting some money. There's absolutely nothing there. This man has no knowledge. What he did, and going back to Your Honor's question about is this a game, I don't know if it's a game. Here's what I think happened. I think that the relator may have had, we don't know for sure what he had, but he may have had some information that he obtained improperly under HIPAA. And he couldn't possibly put that in the pleadings because he would have been telegraphing that he got something improperly. So then what does he do? He goes out and files a public information request to try to then confirm and verify that he has something properly. That's why he didn't put it in the pleading. I don't know if that's a game. I don't know if that's just not having a relator that has the information in order to make the allegations that have been made. It's clear that he had no information. What he does not say in his pleadings, he does not say that he had personal knowledge of the billing or the medical records of any of these physicians or the hospital. He did not have any discussions with any of the physicians directly where they admitted that they did these things at all. The only conversation with any of the physicians was the two at the seafood restaurant that we say, at least in our argument, that he misunderstood, that was a reciprocal billing arrangement, which is perfectly legal. So what he doesn't say is how he formulates or how he gets this information. He doesn't have the knowledge that he purports to say that he has. And in the third amended complaint,
Valerie, is he
out of time already?
Long since. Well,
I'm long since. All right. And just in conclusion, we don't think that Judge Crone made an error in denying the Third Amendment complaint.
Okay. Is there any time left for that side? 2 minutes? All right. That's a blessing.
It sounds to me as if the court knows the issues fairly well. That I don't see how the hospital is distinguished much from the doctors as far as the issues that have been talked about. I would say that the one thing that I have not heard that I do believe needs to be part of the pleadings is I believe that the conspiracy needs to be pled, the nature of the conspiracy, better than what it is pled at either the second or the third amended complaint. In this particular instance, if the court was to look at the second complaint or the third complaint, it would struggle mightily, I think, to determine what the conspiracy actually was and who was a participant in the conspiracy. At best, you have a recitation of facts about a dinner meeting at a local restaurant in Beaumont, Texas, in which, giving all benefits of the doubt, the conspiracy is to bill for services that are not rendered, and there is an innocuous or an ambiguous use of the word "we" that is recited in the second amended complaint. That same recitation of the conspiracy is then carried forth to the third with no real substantive changes. I would mention that nowhere in there is Baptist Hospital ever mentioned as being part of this recitation of facts that justify this conspiracy, which we would respectfully submit needs to be pleaded. And if you were to say that that is the conspiracy to bill for services that were not provided, well, the overt acts that are alleged to have occurred by the part of the hospital in the third amended complaint are for rendering services that were not necessary. So the hospital does have some difficulty, first of all, determining how they're part of that conspiracy, which is exactly opposite of what they are alleged to have done. And the case law is pretty clear that there must be a nexus or a causal connection between the underlying scheme and what the alleged overt acts or fraudulent activity is. And as to the hospital, when we start talking about, well, your billing for services are not reasonable or necessary, we would also reference the court to our pleadings and or to our brief that this is an anti-fraud statute, not one that's about negligence and errors of judgment. So as to the hospital, we certainly would agree with the things that Mr. Old and Mr. Toops has mentioned as to Judge Crone and being on the ground and understanding what was going on in this case and her discretion. But as to the hospital, we certainly have a hard time understanding what the conspiracy is that they're in when, even if you give them every benefit of the doubt, it's direct, the overt acts are directly opposite of what that alleged conspiracy is. So I'll be quiet and sit down and ask respectfully that the court affirm Judge Crone's opinion in this particular case or decision. Thank you.
That was an advocate's minute. Yes, that was an advocate's minute.
Yeah. So 2 minutes. We're not lacking advocates today. Okay, we'll call the last case for the morning, Trumbull Steel versus